Right, great. So first of all, just hi to everyone. Hello, it's nice to be here. Nice to meet you. So let me introduce myself just quickly. So I'm James. I've been invited over to do the brainstem thing. And I've been showing the kids the Enigma machine over here. And they're really nice kids as well, and they like it. And I'm really pleased. I'm really happy to be here. I did the public talk on Monday. And just a little bit about me. I was a research mathematician. I was a lecturer and a research mathematician. I did the postdoc thing. And then I wanted to get into this public speaking type thing. So I've been doing that for 5 years now. And so the reason I say this is because you kind of get switched into that mode. So if this is a bit odd as a colloquium, it's because I'm kind of switched into that public speaking mode. So if it's a little bit jarring, just forgive me for that. Because it's odd for me as well. When I go back to colloquiums now and see maths colloquiums, it's like another world. I can't remember it being that way before, but there you go. Now, I'm here to tell you about Alan Turing. And Alan Turing, of course, one of our great 20th century mathematicians. And people talk about Alan Turing, and they talk about him being a World War II codebreaker, and they never really talk about what he did in World War II, especially when you see documentaries and public stuff. So I'm going to tell you exactly what Alan Turing did, and it was remarkable. His reputation is deserved. It's amazing, his stuff. And I'm going to tell you exactly what he did. So this is the plan. So what they needed to do was break this thing, this Enigma machine. I imagine you're familiar with the story, but in case you're not, this is what Nazi Germany were using in World War II to send their secret coded messages, and that's what I've got to show you here. So this, down here at the front, is an original Enigma machine. This was actually used in World War II. It is 77 years old now. It was made in 1936. It's an army Enigma machine. And, well, tell you what, I'm building up to this, right? I'm going to tell you a bit more, and then I'll show you the Enigma. I'm building up the suspense. But we're going to have a good look at how this works. Really amazing machine.
So only Germans used this machine?
Only the Germans were using this, yeah. Yeah, they gave some to the Spanish and to the Swiss and things. But it's the Germans' machine. It is. Other countries had similar machines. This was in fashion at the time. There were other machines like this. But this was the best one. This is what started the trend, really. But I'll tell you all about that. Where they were breaking this code, I will talk about the Polish code breakers as well as the British code breakers. And if I feel like it, I might mention the Americans. but this is where they were doing it in Britain, Bletchley Park. It was halfway between Oxford and Cambridge, because that's where they took code breakers from. Full of very clever people. So they were mathematicians, they were engineers, they were linguists, they were people who were good at puzzles and games. That's what they wanted. These were the people that were breaking these codes. 10,000 people were working at Bletchley Park. It was a huge operation. It was a massive thing. Now, the Germans thought that their code was unbreakable. If we can break this code, we'll be able to read all these secret messages. But it must have been incredibly frustrating. So what's coming up is my impression of what it must have been like to have been a World War II codebreaker. I did say that some bits of this would be rather odd for a colloquium. So it must have been very frustrating. But if we can, yes, we can read all these secrets. Now, there were many, many codebreakers to talk about. So I'm guilty, really, of only focusing on Alan Turing. There is one in particular who has a very close relationship with Waterloo, which I might bring up later. But for now, we're going to talk about Alan Turing. So Alan Turing designed this machine. It's called the bomb, and it was this big, noisy machine. And this machine could then help you break the code. What it could do is it could break the code in 20 minutes, which is remarkable. We really could, for the 1940s especially. So in principle, if I want to be dramatic about it, let's be dramatic about it, you could get a message in, break it before the Germans received the message. So the British would know what was going on in the German army before the Germans knew, right? Which is a slight advantage, as you can imagine. So this is the plan. I want to build up to this. I want to show you how that bomb machine worked, how it broke the Enigma code. That's the big punchline at the end. That's what I'm trying to head towards. What I'm going to do is I'm going to give you sort of a biography of Alan Turing and a history of the Enigma machine. So as they sort of interweave, that's the plan. So I might as well crash on. So last year was the centenary. Look at him. There he is in his little sailor suit. Centenary of Alan Turing's birth. His family, well, his father was a civil servant. His mother came from a family of engineers. His parents spent a lot of time in India, and Alan Turing was spent a lot of time with friends and family in Britain. And these people that he stayed with did not necessarily encourage his scientific interests, which is a slight shame. But after Alan Turing was born, the Enigma machine was born as well, just a few years later. So in 1915, So in 1915, before this point, if you wanted to send code, you'd be using pen and paper stuff, which were either too easy to break, because you look for the common letters, that kind of thing, or if you made it complicated, it's a pain to use. So what they needed was to build a machine that could do you a complicated code for you. So in 1915, the Dutch Navy started to experiment with this idea, making mechanizing codes. They didn't capitalize on this idea, and this idea sort of drifted over to this guy, a guy called Arthur Schirbius. He was a German engineer. There are things called Schirbius principle. There are things named after him. And he painted his idea for this thing called the Enigma machine. So he made a company. He started to sell these machines to businesses. That's the first version of it. That's 1923. That's the Enigma A. As you can see, it's pretty much a typewriter. And you would type your message in, and it would print off a code. And if you type your code in, there's a little notch here. So you go click here. And you type in your code, and it would print off the decode. It would decode for you. And then you could do another setting where you go click again, and you could just use it as a typewriter. So it was office equipment. That's what they were doing. They were selling it to banks and places like that. It didn't sell very well because it was an expensive machine to buy. So eventually, the Navy started to use these Enigma machines. Now, it is a story of Enigma and Alan Turing, so I'll just show you a bit more about Alan Turing. Now, he doesn't know any of this at the moment. He's going to school. There he is in his school uniform. Alan Turing went to a rather posh school called Sherborne School in the UK, and he wasn't having a particularly easy time at school, because I've got his school reports. I'm going to show you Alan Turing's school reports. Zoom. This is from his housemaster. He has good brains as any boy who's been here, and they're good enough for him to get even through useless subjects, such as Latin, French, and English. I think it's Alan Turing who thought these subjects were useless rather than the housemaster. His maths report, not much better. This is his maths report. Not very good. He spends a good deal of time, apparently, in investigations in advanced mathematics to the neglect of his elementary work. His work is dirty. And this is from his headmaster. I hope you will not fall between two stools. If it's to stay at public school, you must aim at becoming educated. If it's to be solely a scientific specialist, he is wasting his time at public school. I always imagine him saying that while holding a pipe as well, looking disapprovingly like that. You're wasting your time. So he wasn't having a particularly easy time. He was kind of an odd one out at school. However, he graduates and he starts studying mathematics at Cambridge University in King's College. There it is, lovely place. Now, again, I'll drag this story back to the Enigma as I sort of switch between them. Enigma now, Alan Turing's at school, but the Enigma is being used by the army. 1928, the following year, 1929, Arthur Schirbius was the inventor. He died. He died in rather bizarre circumstances. Well, I think his horses bolted while he was driving a horse-driven carriage. So it's kind of a 1920s car accident. It's just bizarre, I think. The following year, the company continues, though, and in 1930, right, they start making a military version of the Enigma machine. This was just for the military, and that's what this is here. This is called the Enigma I, or Enigma 1. So this one was made in 1936. The story of this that I'm going to show to you is this was found. This is what I was told. It was found in a French field after the war, and that's all I know. You just imagine it abandoned. That's all I know. The guy who found it was an American cryptographer, And he took this home. This was his souvenir from the war. He took this. And the guy who found it died 14 years ago, something like that. When he died, this machine was sold. And it was sold to a man called Simon Singh. I don't know, do you know Simon Singh? Do you know the author? Simon Singh, there he is. So he wrote this book called The Code Book, which is all about the history of cryptography, which is very good. If you're interested at all, it's really good. And Simon owns this machine. That's Simon Singh's machine. And he lends it to Cambridge University, and they lend it to me, and I take it around, and I show it off. Now, so that you can see it, though, how much did he get? I want to know the price of things. How much did he get it for? Do you know that? To be honest, that's the one question I'm not allowed to answer. Simon has asked me not to say. I might know. I might know. Yeah, the thing I can see people now going, Google. Let's Google that. It is irreplaceable. That's the important thing. It's priceless in that sense because it's one of few left in the world. If you want to see them in a museum, there's less than 20 in museums worldwide. There's about 2 in Canada because I had a check. And the ones in museums are in glass boxes and you can't really get close to them. So yeah, this is really the only one that I really know of that travels around and gets shown off. So it is special. Now, my plan is we can all see it if I do this. Yeah, blah, 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 blah. So we can all have a look at what's going on. Great. Just tilt this bit up. There we go. Right. So one word of warning. It is an old machine. It can be temperamental. It is 77 years old. When you're 77, you're allowed to be temperamental, all right? So it is old, and it should be working, and I think it will, but sometimes it doesn't because it's old. But fingers crossed, it will be fine. So we'll take a look. So we'll open up the lid. Wow. There it is. And it's a typewriter, and it looks like a typewriter, and it works pretty much like a typewriter. It is 1930s technology. It's all wood and steel. But a quick demo then. So I'm going to type in a message. It should be something in German, but I'll keep it easy. I'll just say hello to you. So I'm going to type in hello in the machine. We'll see what it does. So if I'm sending hello, you'd type in H. Oh, let's see if I can get it to work. Yeah, got it. And the letter F lights up. The code lights up. H is F. E is an I. L, oh, if it works for me, there we go, is a P. The second L in hello is a D. And you finish it with the O, and that's an L. So that's the code. Yeah. Are the batteries included? It has batteries inside. It would have had a big 1940s acid battery inside. I'll show you. I'll have a look. I'll show you how it works. The important thing to notice were the two L's were different. If you know cryptography, it's a polyalphabetic cipher. It means each letter of the message is sent with a different substitution code. So it's different there. I'm pressing A repeatedly. And it's going to be different each time. And there's no pattern to this from the outside. It's a mechanical machine, yes. But from the outside, it's a fake kind of random. Now, I'll come to that. I'm building. I'm ahead of you. Right. I'll show you the insides first, though. So if you want to know the battery, that compartment in the top right corner, that would be the battery. And this is a conversion. With the wires coming out, that's a modern battery, but that would have been filled with a 40s battery. And what you've made is a circuit. The wires are inside these rotors, and inside it's lots of crisscross wiring. And it is a large circuit. When I press a letter, let's get one to light up. Go on, there we go. You make a circuit, and it connects to that bulb so it lights up. Very simple, just a simple circuit. But the wires inside here turn as I type. So when they turn, the battery connects to one of the other bulbs instead, and you get a different bulb. So it's 26 bulbs in parallel, and you just change which one connects to the battery, and that change which one lights up. Do it again, move the wires, and now it's that one that's connected to the battery instead. You've got 3 rotors in the machine. They actually come out. They swap order, so you can change the order of the rotors. Each one has 26 starting places, and something else to show you at the front of the machine. This was a military edition. Only the military had this. The commercial did not have this. At the front, in black, and I'm going to pull this out to show you, we We have these things here. We have these wires. It's called the plug board, and it's like an old-fashioned telephone switchboard or an old patch board. We have, at this moment, we have six of these wires at the front of the machine, and they connect letters in pairs. So you'll connect one letter to another. So you connect A with T or something like that. And you'll make six pairs of letters down here at the front. Now, maybe to give you a better idea, what I've got to show you is over here. I've got a simulator. So this is an Enigma machine simulator. There's a few of these around on the internet, but this is a nice one. So all you need to do, this works the same as mine. If you press a letter, F, F becomes E. Right, so F becomes E. If I click this button, it shows you the wiring inside. This is the wires inside Enigma. And it's just full of these crisscross wirings. But if you look what happens, when I pressed, what did I press? F. If you follow that yellow line, that's your circuit. So you go through the machine, scramble, scramble. It actually loops back and then does the same again in reverse. So it goes through the machine for a second time. And it connects to E, and E would light up. But if I press F repeatedly, you can see what happens. The wires move. So F becomes D, then the wires move, and F becomes W. I mean, if you want to put it in mathematical terms, it's a composition of general substitution ciphers and da-da-da-da. But it's, yeah, it's just a big loop, a circuit. That's what you're making. So that's why it changes each time. Now, how do we get the message back again? Because we need to decode the message. This is clever. Right. We decode a message. What I'm going to do is I'm going to say a quick message just to show you how it works. I'll just say hi. So I'll just go hi to you. So I'm going to send that message in code. So H is X, I, oh, misfire. Let me try that again. So it's going to be different now. H is a P, I, is a V. PV is your code. The machine doesn't transmit, so you have to write that down. Then someone would transmit it by radio signals, and it would travel to maybe a ship in the ocean, somewhere like that. And they've got an Enigma machine as well. And their machine is the same as the first Enigma machine, exactly. Now, when I typed in hi, the rotor here moved. It moved two places. I'm going to have to move this back to where it was. I'm going to reset the machine by moving this back. Don't confuse me like that. Hang on. Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was. I don't know. 5 years of doing this, and you think I know that. Right. So reset the machine. I hope I've done that right. I may have made a mistake now. We'll see. I'm going to type in the code now. It's reset. PV. Let's see if it works. And I was nervous about that P, because that's the dodgy key. All right. Third time lucky. Give me your goodwill. Here we go. Give it a bit of a spin as well. All right. Hi's the message. Here's the code again. M, W, resets the machine. Bop, bop. Type in the code MW. Here we go. M, yes, is an H. And W is an I. So it codes and decodes for you. So it's a very clever machine. So the Germans were very proud of this. It's a very clever machine. It codes and decodes for you. What it does is it makes a pair. The Enigma machine makes pairs. Yeah, another person way ahead of me. I'm coming to it. Very next thing I say, I promise. I'm going to tell you everything. Just to say that, just one more thing before I do that. It does make a pair. If I press A, that becomes an O. Now reset, O will be an A. That's how it codes and decodes. It makes 13 pairs out of the alphabet. So it codes and decodes. One thing I didn't say as well, this rotor on the right, it moves every time. When it does a full revolution, it kicks the next rotor one place. Let me try and make that happen. I don't know when it's going to happen. There. When the middle rotor does a full revolution, it kicks the left-hand rotor one place. So you got the fast rotor always moving, a middle rotor and a slow rotor. Right. Those two people, they need to be set the same. Yeah. How did they do that? Those settings were written down for you on a sheet of paper. They'd have a big sheet of paper with the settings written down. It looked like this. So this is the code book, the code sheet, or the key sheet. And let me show you how it works. It changes every day. The settings change every day. So that's the date. on the left-hand side, 31, 30, 29, and so on. This bit is the rotors. So the rotors can swap order. And it was just 1, 2, and 3, rotor 1, rotor 2, rotor 3. So that tells you which order to put them in. With three rotors, there were six ways to arrange them. This thing, Ringstellung, the ring setting, is something I've not talked about. But on the outside of the rotor, they are labeled with 1, 2, 3, 4, or A, B, C, D. They have labels. And those labels actually turn. There's a little notch that you can move, and they actually rotate. So if you rotate the labeling on the rotor, it changes your setup. So those need to be in the right places. That's the labeling there. That tells you how to label the rotors. 26 ways you can do that for each rotor. So it's 26, 26, 26. So it's 26 cubed, 17,576. For this, these are pairs of letters, and that's the plug board at the front of the machine. That was six pairs of letters that you make at the front of the machine. Those are the instructions that tell you what to do, which pairs to make. So you pair it up in that way. This is the military edition. This is what they were pleased with. This has the greatest number of combinations. It is 100 billion ways you can do that. So they were very happy with that. And this ground setting, it's pretty much the rotor starting position. Each rotor has 26 starting places. So again, it's 26, 26, 26. So that's another 17,576. To find out how many ways to do it all together, you would multiply this out, except you don't need the ring setting. The ring setting doesn't increase the combinations. It changes how you label the combinations, but it doesn't increase the combinations. So we can ignore that. So you multiply the others together, and the total settings for the Enigma machine, this is in 1930, that's where we are at the moment, is, there you go, 10 to the 16, 10,000 trillion, if you want to say it like that. So you can't check all the possible ways to set the machine. So it's a very good machine. There is one more thing to say. If every message, and there would be dozens or hundreds of Enigma messages every day, if they were all using the same setting, that would be bad security. So you can't have all messages using the same setting. What they did instead is that each message would be sent with its own secret starting position. And they would have to send that secret starting position at the beginning of the message. I'll show you how that works as well. So you would set a secret starting position. So you would set the Enigma machine, to the ground setting, which is written for you on that piece of paper. And let's say XYZ as an example. That's written down for you. You would set your machine. The operator could then pick a secret setting. He's going to pick ABC. That's the rotor starting place, ABC. That's his secret setting for that message. He's going to send ABC to the other guy at the beginning of the message in code. And he uses the Enigma machine to send it in code. He types in ABC twice into the Enigma machine. Sorry, ABC into the Enigma machine. He makes six letters of code, JTEQGL in that example. And then he would send that at the start of the message. At the other end, the other guy with the Enigma machine would decode those six letters with his Enigma machine. And he gets ABC, ABC. And then he knows that ABC is the secret setting for the rest of the message. So each message got its own starting place. You. Right. So the first people. Oh, go on. A couple of questions.
I'm a bit confused now, but.
Yeah, go on. It is confused.
If the Allies got one of these somehow.
Yeah.
Right? And then, so this paper that you showed came with it. It's not like every month they have a new edition of it. It's just, you know, every day of the month.
Yeah, so every day of the month is a different setting, and then the book gets replaced at the end of the month for a new book. Yeah, if you can steal it, great. Then you know the key, and you can break the code or decode. For the rest of the month, exactly, until it runs out. You have to work on the assumption that you're not going to get those books, because you wouldn't. Only a few missions ended up with those code books. So most of the time, you don't have the code book. So for the Allies, they have to assume you don't have the key. Stealing it is one way to solve the problem. Go on, say that again.
They still could have had access to the machine, right?
Yes, they did have access to the machine. I'll show you. That's what the Polish were doing. That's where I was going to next. So the Polish were breaking this code first. Go on.
Question. So why do they send the setting twice? Is that to avoid errors?
Yeah, to avoid errors. To avoid errors. But again, that's going to come back. That's going to come back to catch them out in a second. Yeah. Oh, lots of questions. This is going to take ages. So the two machines, say that again, sorry.
Then how do you decode
the beginning? What, this six-letter thing? So how do you, just to repeat how you get that six-letter thing, the two machines are set the same. Their setting, XYZ, is written down on their codebook. And that's the setting for this little six-letter bit. And then you get this. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, that's it. You got it. Oh, gosh. I'm going to have to take one more. I'm going to have to move on. Sorry.
So it's not exactly clear that you get any extra security from this extra secret setting. I mean, if the guy knows that the first six characters are an encoding of the new secret setting, then can't he just all the code book?
Yes. If anyone with a code book would know how to decode it. But people without a code book, this makes it harder because you're not using exactly the same key for each message.
Oh, it does.
Okay. All right. So just to get back to my story, the Polish were doing this first in 1932. There we go. So they started, this is Marian Rejewski, a young mathematician. This is when they started getting mathematicians in to tackle this problem. So Rejewski set up, just by your own logic, looking at the codes without one of these Enigma machines, just from the codes, and through a process of logic, had worked out the wiring for inside the Enigma machine without seeing the machine itself. He set up all these equations. He needed some information to put into his equations, although he had worked it out. And he needed to steal one of these key sheets. He needed that information to put into his formulas. So they needed a spy, this guy. This is Hans Tilo Schmidt. Hans Tilo Schmidt was from a well-to-do family, but Hans was down on his luck. But his brother was a general in the German army, and his brother got him a job. And part of Hans' job was to destroy Enigma codebooks. And instead of destroying Enigma codebooks, he would sell them to the French. And the French would pass them to the Polish, and the Polish that said, well, fantastic, that's exactly what Rejewski needed. He put that into his equations, and yes, he could work out the wiring of the Enigma machine. And then they were building their own Enigma machines. They could build replicas of the Enigma machine without seeing the machine. So the machine was never the mystery. The machine part of it is not the problem. The problem is the secret setting, right? The settings that change every day. That's the bit they don't know. That's the bit they have to work out. So when I do this in public talks, I tend to skip this bit. Now, I usually say, you know, Polish were doing this, and the Germans were doing this, and there's a fight. I'm actually going to tell you what the Polish did. So I don't usually do this, so I get to do this with you. So they had this repetition. This is what you were saying, that's a bit odd, repetition. So you've got this ABC, ABC at the start of the message. Because it's repeated, you know that the first letter and the fourth letter are going to be the same. You can use that to help you work this out. So you're going to look at the first letter and the fourth letter of the coded bit, the J and the Q. And you say that J becomes Q. But you get lots of these Enigma messages every day. So let's take a few more and see what I get. Same thing here. I'm going to say that Q becomes a T. And here I'm going to say T becomes a J. And with those three examples, you can see I've made a little cycle. J becomes Q, Q becomes T, and T becomes a J. If you're happy with group theory and mathematics, it's symmetric group stuff. Actually, I've hooked up two Enigma machines together. That's what happens. So you make this little cycle, J, Q, and T. Do it again for the rest of those Enigma messages you get that day. And you make lots of cycles. So loads of these messages, and you get a whole lot of cycles. And each Enigma setting has its own particular set of cycles. It's a fingerprint. Each setting generates its own set of cycles. So what the Polish did was they made a book of all the Enigma settings and all the cycles that that Enigma setting produces. Then all they need to do is take some Enigma messages, look at the cycles they make, look at, like a phone book, just look up which setting that corresponds to, and they can know what the setting is for that day. It took them a year to do that. It was called the card catalog. So this big catalog, look at the cycles, check it out, tells you the setting. Fine, but there is a fight here between the Germans and the Polish. So the Germans then changed their procedures. So what they did next is they stopped using the ground setting that was in the code book. That's what I was talking about over here. When they have a ground setting, it was XYZ in my example. That was written down for you. They said, don't do that anymore. Do it this way instead. They said, you are now allowed to pick your ground setting for yourself. So each message had its own particular ground setting. And you would send it in plain at the start of the message. Then everything else is the same. You send that in plain, three letters, and then you'd send your secret setting. And you get the secret six letters here. So this broke the card catalog. So that no longer worked. So for this, they found another way to break it. Hi.
Why will they start changing procedures? Did you suspect?
It was a routine increase in security, and I don't think they suspected. No. Does that sound fair? So it's all right. Yeah, I think it was just routine, just increasing security. So for this type of message, they had to do something different. What the Polish were looking for now were these six letters where you had the same coded letter in the first and fourth place. W in that example. I've got the same letter there. That was called females. I think that's a mistranslation. I think it's meant to be fixed points. I think that was a mistranslation from the Polish. So these are fixed points where the same letter has been encrypted as the same letter in the code. You do this again for some other Enigma messages you get that day. So here's another one. I'm looking for the same letter though, W in this time, in the second and fifth. And then the same letter again in the third and sixth. If you can find the same letter appearing six times in different places, what the idea is, you can imagine having six Enigma machines, and they're all giving you the same letter W in their six different positions. So what they did is, yeah, imagine six Enigma machines. If you're putting them in the right places, they're all going to give you the same letter W. That's what's happened there. So they built this machine called Bomba. Bomba, so it was six Enigma machines. Can you see where they can stack the six rotors? So they've got six Enigma machines going at once. And if they're in the correct places, they're all going to output the same letter. And that tells you what the setting is. It was called Bomba. Some say it was named after a type of ice cream. Some say it's named after the ticking noise it used to make. Some say it's just as good a name as any. It'll do. They needed one of these Bomba machines for each rotor order. And there's three rotors, so there's six rotor orders. So you need six Bomba machines to go through the positions. And then they increased security again, and the Germans added two extra rotors. So now they would have a box of five, and you would pick three from a box of five. And there are 60 ways you can do that. So now you need 60 Bomba machines, and they couldn't do that. They didn't have the resources, couldn't cope with making that many Bomba machines. And that's when the Polish had this secret meeting in Kabaki Woods in Poland with the British codebreakers. And then the Polish passed on their ideas to the British codebreakers. And these replicas that they made, they passed on those ideas. So that's the Polish. That's what's happening in the 1930s. That's the Polish stuff in the 1930s. This is all before the invasion of Poland. This is 5 weeks before. This meeting was 5 weeks before the invasion of Poland. Now, I'm going to drag this back to Alan again. I haven't talked about him for a while. He was at university at this point. So he graduates in 1934, and then he does a master's. He does a mathematics master's, and he decided to tackle one of the great unsolved problems of mathematics at this time. At the beginning of the 20th century, you may know the Hilbert problems. These were 23 problems that David Hilbert set as a challenge to 20th century mathematicians. And part of these problems was this thing called the decision problem. And there may be people in here who know this better than I do, because this is not quite my area. But I think the idea is, if I can try and do the gist, is he wanted to know whether there was a mathematical algorithm, a general mathematical algorithm, that could tell you whether something was true or false, because that would be great. And so Alan Turing decided to take on this problem, and to solve it, he conceived of a hypothetical machine that would do a job of a man. And the machine he called the computing machine. And the man whose job it replaces, he calls the computer. And that's the beginning of computer science today. And Alan Turing does solve this problem. He actually solves it in the negative. You can't have a general method for telling me whether something is true or false. It's not possible. If you did, it actually makes an impossible computing machine. It's a contradiction. And he solves this problem, the great unsolved problem, when he's 22 years old. 22, 23 years old. Yeah, I know, swine. He publishes, this is before his PhD, so he publishes this, Turing machines. Then he goes and does his PhD in Princeton. He comes back to Britain 2 years later. He starts working part-time with the code breakers, and he starts beginning to think about Enigma machines. This is interesting, which is worth pointing out. Turing publicly supported the asylum of Jewish refugees into Britain, which shows that he's involved in the war, sort of intellectually and politically as well. He publicly supported these asylum seekers. Now, the day after war is declared, Alan Turing reports for duty at Bletchley Park, and he's put in charge of something called Hut 8. Hut 8 was in charge of breaking Navy codes. So he was put in charge of breaking the Navy Enigma code. See, there was a problem. The Polish ideas worked very well for breaking Army and Air Force Enigma codes. But the Navy were doing something different. The Navy had a different way of using the machine. And the Polish hadn't worked out what that was. And that was an unsolved problem. So great for Alan Turing, he loved that. He went, great, I have this all to myself. So I'm going to show you what Alan Turing worked out. This is the Navy way of sending Enigma messages. It's different from the Army way. This is what he worked out. Okay, this is the first thing. Right, so this is Alan Turing Maths 1. This is what he did. He worked out the Navy procedure. First, what the Navy were doing. They were sending that secret setting. Do you remember my ABC thing? It's the same idea, but they had a different way to do it. What they did is they would pick two triplets of letters from a book. They have a book that they pick this from. So HLG will be one, and KQK will be the second. And they would take those two letters, or two triplets of letters. They would write them in two rows, like that. Just offset by one place, so there's a space. And then they would fill those spaces in. The operator would pick two letters he likes, and he fills those spaces in. And what he's made are four pairs of letters. I've got AK and HQ and LK and GZ. So he makes four pairs of letters. He then had a code book, and he had a code book that would turn pairs into a different pair, substitutes one pair for another. This is the code book. They go bigram table. You turn one pair into something else. So let's do that. So I take my pairs and I turn them into something else using the code book. And that's what I send at the start of the message. B, D, A, P, E, M, E, J. Those are the pairs that I send at the start of the message. That's the code for the secret setting. At the other end, the other guy would then decode that using his book. So that's easy enough. He just reverses that, decodes it, and he gets the original triplets. The first one, HLG, is just to confirm you're using the same day. That's just a confirmation that you're on the right day. The second triplet, KQK, this, not quite the secret setting yet, one more step, What you do is you take that KQK, you would then type it into the Enigma machine, and it makes three letters, IYS in my example. And that's your secret setting. IYS is the secret setting. The difference between the Army and the Navy is that the Navy were using a machine to generate their secret setting rather than letting the operator pick it, which means it was more random and more secure, whereas the Army were letting them pick it for themselves, and people aren't random enough. They're not secure enough. So this makes the machine give you the secret setting, IYS. And that's the setting. And Alan Turing worked this out. Now, part of working this out is you needed those code books, those bigram tables, those pairs.
Wasn't there a different machine to produce a random number?
Say that again, sorry.
So what did they use to produce this random number?
This was used by the Enigma machine. The Enigma machine was producing those random three letters.
Was it an add-on or just a regular?
Just the regular Enigma machine. The same Enigma machine they use for everything else. Now, they have to steal these books. So to steal these books, they had to come up with a plan to steal these books. It's good. Right. I'm going to show you the plan. This is the guy who came up with the plan. This is Ian Fleming. Ian Fleming, author of the James Bond books, was the assistant to the head of Naval Military Intelligence in World War II. He's pretty high up there. The James Bond books are based on fact. And Ian Fleming knew that these Bletchley Park codebreakers needed these Navy code books, and so it was his job to come up with a plan to steal them. So this is, I'll tell you Ian Fleming's plan, right? This is his plan to steal codebooks. Right. Step one, steal a German bomber airplane. Right, that's step one. I don't know how he's going to do that. That's step one. Step two, to fill the airplane with the hardest, toughest men you can find. Then to take your bomber airplane, to go down to the coast, and to wait for a bomber raid to come over Britain. To take your fake bomber aeroplane, to ditch it into the English Channel as if it had been part of the raid but had crashed. To then send out a distress signal, and then when a German ship comes to help, to leap on the ship, kill the crew, hijack the ship. Yep, and they nearly did it as well. They nearly did it. So they got the bomber aeroplane, still don't know how they did that. They went down to Dover on the coast, and they were waiting. And what they were waiting for was for the right type of ship to come by to do this. And the right type of ship never came by. And in the end, the operation was cancelled. But it's fascinating, isn't it? And it kind of gives you an idea of where Ian Fleming gets his ideas from for things like, not Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, for things like the James Bond books, in particular From Russia With Love, which is about James Bond trying to negotiate for or steal a Russian code machine, which is essentially a thinly veiled reference to Enigma. He's just talking about Enigma. That's what he's doing. So it's based on his own war experience. It was disappointing that it was cancelled. This is a quote about Turing. There you go. Turing and Twin came to me like undertakers cheated of a nice corpse. All in a stew about the cancellation of Operation Ruthless. Other missions did end up with those code books, though. So other missions did. So they had the code books, and it confirmed exactly what Alan Turing thought, which is amazing. And they now needed to use these books to break the code. So here's another bit of maths. This is Alan Turing Maths 2. Now, I don't do this very often, so bear with me. This is stats. So your mileage may vary, but this is a statistical approach. So the Navy were using three rotors from actually a choice of eight, more than the Army, three from eight. So 336 ways to range the rotors, which is too many. We want to reduce that, shorten that down. Alan Turing had a way to work out which rotors were being used in the machine. What you would do is, you would take two Enigma messages, and you would decode that little beginning bit. And if you decode the beginning bit, you would get these key indicators. There's my KQK again, and there's a KQB. The thing is, those are close together. Those triplets are close together because the only change with the B there and the K there. So if you type them into the machine, it will produce you your secret setting, but your secret settings are close together as well. If you get IYS with that, you might get something close like IYV, something close. That's the idea. So those two messages are being sent with a setting that are close together, right? But we're not sure exactly how close they are, right? So this is only an example. These were three places apart, but that's only an example. We don't know exactly how far apart they are. So if you took your two messages, there's my two Enigma messages. If these are three steps apart, if you shift the second one three places across, they're now in sync. They're being sent using the same setting. Each letter there are being sent using the same thing. That puts them in the same place. You're going to use that to help you work out the rotors. What you do is, we don't know it's out of step by three. There are actually 50 ways that you could align them. It's 25 to the right and 25 to the left. But one of them puts them in sync. 49 of them do not. One of them does. Which one is it? We're going to find out which one it is. So to find the correct alignment, we're going to look for matching letters. Letters that match the two messages. Let's see, there's two W's there, if you can see. You see, matching letters will happen more frequently if they're in sync. In fact, two letters will match with a probability of 1 out of 17 if they're in the same position. If they're not in the same position, if they're not in sync, depth, that's what they called it in those days, it's just random letters. It's like matching two random letters, which is 1 out of 26. If you divide those two probabilities, it's Bayes' theorem. Again, you might not be familiar with that, or you might be, I don't know. But Bayes' theorem says you divide those two, and you get this factor. So each match is evidence that you are in sync or in depth. You divide them, and it increases the odd. Each match increases the odds by 1.53. So each match makes it more likely to be in sync. So let's do that. Oh, and even runs of successful matches increases the odds even more, because you might get a short word that's just happened to have lined up in the same place, like the or D, das. So you take these two messages and you look for how many matches we've got. So I've got there, I've done it here, bop, 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 and there's 9 matches there. That actually increases the probability from 1 out of 50, because there's 50 possible ways you could, to 8 out of 9, 89%. It goes from 2% to 89%. So this looks like they're in sync. This looks like they're in the same position. Great. Each alignment had a score. Instead of using these awkward numbers, 1.53, you'd have a score. Each match would give you a score of 4 points. And then you'd look for how many points you've got. You just add it that way. And if you get over 34, you're more likely to be in sync than not. Right, so you've found it. You think you've found it, right? Where they're in sync. And you can use that to work out the output of the Enigma machine. So this example has 52. There you go. So if this is a shift of 3, they would write that as an equation. They would say this K and this B. They would say K plus 3 equals B. That just means they're 3 places out of sync. But it helps you work out the output. So what you do is, for example, if the Enigma machine, if K becomes A on the Enigma machine, then B is 3 places later than A. It becomes D. So it adds 3 to the output. So if K becomes A, B becomes D, because it's 3 places later. But that means there are some things that aren't possible. If K becomes B, that means B becomes E. Now that's not possible, because the Enigma machine made pairs of letters. Do you remember when I did the S became something and something becomes S? It's a pair. That's not a pair. K becomes B, B becomes E. It's a cycle of 3. That's not a pair. So that's not possible. So no, not all are possible. So you look for which ones are possible, and you can deduce the output. You do this a few more times with a few more messages. And I deduce, eventually, this output. I've decided that K becomes T on the Enigma machine. That means three places later, B becomes W. And you do some more of this, and you get some more of these relations. This big gap, this hole, tells you which rotor's in the machine. That big hole means you're using rotor 1, because rotor 1 turns at this position, which means the relationships don't carry over, and you get a hole in that position. So when you get a hole, it tells you it's rotor 1. And you go, hey, and you've worked out which rotor it is. And so you don't have to check the 336 ways of arranging those rotors. You actually know, or you can actually work out, the right-hand rotor, and with a bit more hard work, the middle rotor too. The hardest one to work out is the left-hand rotor. That's the slow one on the left. So that's not easy. That's hard. That's stats, that's Bayesian and mathsy stuff. This is Alan Turing's idea, though. This is Alan Turing's stats. This is his maths to work out the rotor. Now, this is a good time to talk about, we have a break now. Well, we'll talk about Alan Turing just a bit more in general terms. So Alan Turing has a reputation for being a bit of an eccentric at Bletchley Park. He was known as the professor because he had this professorial air. He's only 28, but apparently he's the professor. There are stories of him cycling into work wearing his gas mask because he had hay fever. So he'd wear his gas mask, and you have to imagine all the tubes coming out and his gas mask on, he's cycling in, like an alien cycling into work. There are stories of him chaining his coffee mug to the radiator so no one could steal his mug, which is usually told as an example of how eccentric he was. Seems fairly fine to me, seems fairly reasonable. Seems like a good idea. What's wrong with that? Less well known, he was a very talented long-distance runner. Alan Turing would run for meetings from Bletchley Park to London, which is 60 miles. He would run to meetings. His marathon time is only 11 minutes short of the world record at that time. He was seriously considered for the 1948 Olympics. This is not the result of a casual hobby. Some other stories. We've got a story of action this day with Winston Churchill. Because they were suffering from lack of resources and lack of staff at Bletchley Park. And Alan Turing, completely naughty, you shouldn't do this, going over the heads of all his bosses, he wrote a letter directly to Winston Churchill complaining about the lack of resources at Bletchley Park. To his credit, Winston Churchill then wrote to his staff saying, action this day, give these guys everything they want, top priority. Winston Churchill personally supported their work when other leaders may not have, but Winston Churchill did. Another story, in the same year, 1941, Alan Turing proposes to one of the girls that works for him, a girl called Joan Clark. She was a mathematician too. The engagement didn't last very long when he revealed that he was gay. This did not come as a surprise to her, apparently. She wasn't shocked. And he was openly gay at that point. You may have heard what happened to Alan Turing at the end of his life in the 1950s after the war. It was discovered that he was gay, and he was arrested, and he was treated very badly. He lost his job as a codebreaker. He was barred from coming back to the United States because he was an undesirable type, and they put him on hormone treatment to straighten him out. And in the end, he poisoned himself. He took an apple, he laced it with cyanide, he took a bite out of it, and poisoned himself. Would you believe me then if I told you that that's where the logo for Apple Computers comes from? Which is the apple with the bite taken out? No, it's not true. No, it's not true. It sounds true, though. No, it's not true. No, and that's a myth, right? That's a myth that goes around. So you may have heard that before. And it is a myth. Steve Jobs actually says, oh, I wish it was true, but it's actually the apple of Newton. And it used to have a rainbow as well, which was light refraction, so it used to be Newton. And the dent was actually him going bop on his head, bop. So it's not Alan Turing, but it sounds like it, doesn't it? So this brings me on to what I was building up to. This is what I was going towards. Alan Turing's bomb machine. This was his machine now for breaking the code. So they could reduce the rotors with that stats. And they've worked out the Navy ideas and stuff. But this is his bomb machine. So I'll show you how this works. So, gentlemen, this is Alan Turing 3. There we go. So there is a flaw in the machine, although it's very good. If I press a letter repeatedly, it could be anything on the Enigma machine except itself. A letter doesn't become itself. It makes a pair, so it doesn't pair with itself. So you can't have A becoming A or Z becoming Z. So a letter can't be itself. You're going to use this as your clue. You take a message and you try and guess a word that's in that message. What the Germans would do, 6 o'clock every morning, they would send a weather report. And it was always the same. The weather report was always the same, apart from the actual weather. But it was a standard format. It was a standard thing. So they could use that to work out what it said. They knew what it said. So they're going to take a phrase, and I'm going to use the phrase weather report, or Wetterbericht. There you go, in German, Wetterbericht. We're going to look for where that phrase fits into the code. So I'm just going to slide it under the code and see where it fits. So there's my code there, and there's my Wetterbericht underneath. Where does it fit? Well, a letter can't become itself. So if I move this word one place to the left, can you see those T's would match up? So it can't fit there. T can't be T. It doesn't work. If you moved it one place to the right instead, you'd have those R's matching up, which doesn't fit, doesn't work.
This is a question, because each of the rotors gives a number of permutation groupings, a combination of permutation.
Mm.
And there are permutations which send letters to the
same. Yes, yeah, right, yeah.
So why you would think that it would be hard to exclude the
case? Yeah, so this is not the most general type of substitution you could have, and that's for mechanical reasons, to build that machine. To make it lightweight, to make it portable, they did this pairing thing. That's why it codes and decodes in an easy way. It makes itself inverse. So you type the same thing in twice and you'll get back to where you started. That's on purpose. Sorry to say that again. So it's a particular class of the general substitution, yeah. Yeah, it's not the most general way you could do it. It's not. So if I get back to it, this does fit. You don't have matching letters there, so that does fit. And there's nothing that says that doesn't work. That's great. So it might fit here. One thing they did next, this is not too important, but I will show you, don't need to worry about it, is they would make that into a diagram. So in the first place, A becomes W. In the second place, T becomes E. In the third place, Q becomes T. They would draw that as a diagram. It looks like this. Those two things are the same. Can you see, in the first place, A becomes W. In the second place, T becomes E, Q becomes T in the third place. Those two things are the same. Well, it turns out that diagrams with loops were better clues. That's what they wanted. So we're going to use this now to work out the plug board. At the front of the machine, we have this plug board. I said there were 6 pairs of letters at the front. In the war, they increased it to 10. So now they had 10 pairs of letters, made it 10,000 times harder. Now, we're going to work these plug board pairs out. What I'm going to do is, first of all, I'm going to use my crib there, that guess, that Wetterbericht. And in the second place, I had T becomes E. I'm going to use that. I'm going to draw a diagram of an Enigma machine, but I'm just going to make it into a magic box. So there's an Enigma machine. That's the most simplified way I could draw an Enigma machine. I press T, it goes through the magic box, and E comes out the other side. I've split it into the plug board, the rotors combined into a big box, the plug board for a second time, then it comes out as E. And you make a guess. You're trying to work out the plug board at the front, so you'll make a guess about it. One guess. I'm going to guess that T is connected to A. That's my guess. What would happen if that's true? If T is connected to A, then T goes through the plug board and A comes out. Then A goes through the rotors. Now, all you need to do, we know how the rotors are wired up. That's not a mystery. So you pick a position, send A through, and see what happens. So pick a position, send A through, and for example, let's say A goes through the rotors and comes out as P. Now, that forces me to deduce that P goes through the plug board and comes out as E. Which means I'm forced to deduce that P is connected to E on the plug board. So you get a plug board setting. I've now got deduced P is connected to E. I'm just going to do it a few more times. Take that Wetterbericht guess. Do it a few more times. Get a few more plug board settings. There you go, four more times. The first one is what I did. That was PE. Second one, do it again. K connected to Q. Do it again. X is connected to B. Do it again. T is connected to G. There is a problem with that last one, if you can see. I've deduced that T is connected to G, but I started by saying T was connected to A, and it can't be both. So that means you conclude that you have a contradiction, something's gone wrong, TA was not correct. That was incorrect. Throw it away, you got that wrong. So you try another guess. T is not connected to A, so try T connected to B. And if that doesn't work, try T connected to C. Try and work out which letter T is connected to. It could be any letter. You say it's connected to C, D, E, F, Z. Go through all the 26 possibilities. If none of them work, it's your rotor position that's wrong. And you go click, and you try the next rotor position. So if all your plug board assumptions are wrong for any given letter, it could be T, if they all give you contradictions, then it's your rotor position that's wrong, and you try the other. Now we need to speed this up, because that's going to take too long. Right, a couple of ways to speed this up. Another Alan Turing idea. Once you've found a contradiction, you can reject all other consequences. When I did that example, I had TG, which I can reject. TA, I can reject. I had XB, I can reject that as well. That's not going to work. And I had QK or something, and that you can throw that away. Everything you deduce, if you find one mistake, all the other deductions are wrong as well. It's all fruit of a poison tree. So you can all reject it together at the same time. It's a process of elimination. And it was faster to do it this way as a process of elimination. Throw away things that are wrong. So you can reject all those things together. You're actually looking for things that are wrong. That's what you want. So you can reject all the other things. And this can be done instantaneously with electrical circuits. That's what the bomb machine was. It was a big Enigma machine, like simultaneous Enigma machines. And all it was doing was, electrically, you put your guess in, TA was my guess. The electricity will flow through the machine. It will go through TG and go, wrong. And will flow through all the other things that I found out and go, wrong, and reject them. And it will do that straight away, instantly. And then it will go, click, and try the next one. And you can check all the settings in 20 minutes. And until you're only left with the correct solution. That's what you do, and you can check that. And that's what they built. They built it in March 1940. It was called Victory. And a couple of months later, good idea, the Germans changed their procedures again, the repetition, the ABC, ABC. They stopped doing it in 1940. And that repetition was what the Polish were using to break the code. Without that, they were exclusively using the bomb machines for the rest of the war. And that's what they did. And that's how the bomb machine works. Phew. Right. Just a couple of things. Oh, I have gone over by 5 minutes. I apologize. If you give me 2 minutes, I wanted to sort of show you a couple of things that you may have heard of before, and you might be thinking, I've heard, and he's not mentioned this thing, and I know about this, and he's not mentioned it. So I'm just trying to anticipate some things. You may have heard of the four rotor Enigma machines that the U-boats were using. They started doing that in 1942, not straight away. It was just a conversion of the three rotor machines. Alan Turing didn't have anything to do with that, really. He worked out the wiring for the last rotor. Bad news, we were blocked out of the code for 10 months when they did that. But eventually, we broke that code as well. You may have heard of Colossus. That's a famous machine at Bletchley Park. So Colossus was built to break a machine called Lorenz. That's a code machine the Germans were using, Lorenz. It was being used by Hitler and the top level of the Nazi party, the most important people. Now, a mathematician called Bill Tutt broke that code. Bill Tutt is the guy I mentioned at the very beginning. After the war, he emigrated to Waterloo, and he lived here for the rest of his life. He was a mathematician at the maths department at the University of Waterloo. And he broke the Lorenz code, that's Hitler's code machine. And we were reading those messages too. So you've got a celebrity for here. And Tommy Flowers was a man who built the Colossus. That was the machine, that was the code-breaking machine for Lorenz. arguably the world's first computer. So surprised you dropped something. Just to wrap up who I talked about, Rejewski was the Polish mathematician. He escaped to Britain eventually, and he broke codes. He continued breaking Enigma codes, but he was breaking it for the Polish government, even though he lived in Britain. And they did not communicate or talk to the British code breakers, even if they're in the same country. Did not talk to each other. Hans Thilo Schmidt was the German spy. He committed suicide. They found him out. He committed suicide. The Enigma machines, what happened to them? After the war, the Allies started to collect up the Enigma machines and they started to sell them to foreign embassies. And they would say, hey, do you want to buy an Enigma machine? They're really good. Ask the Germans. The Germans swear by it. We were selling a machine we could break. This is what espionage is like. Alan Turing, at the end of the war, he was working as a consultant rather than actively involved in it. He was actually trying to build a speech encryption machine so you could talk into it and it would encrypt your speech. Well ahead of his time. After the war, he continued his work in computing, artificial intelligence, and mathematical biology. Particularly, why do you get a Fibonacci number of spirals in a sunflower? That's one of the things he was interested in. That was his first use for the machine, the computer they made at Manchester. After the war, though, he was recognized for his work. He got an OBE in secret, because it was a secret thing, but he did get an OBE. And I'll finish with this quote from one of the code breakers about Turing. They said, "There should be no question in anyone's mind that Turing's work was the biggest factor in Hut 8's success." And you can say Bletchley Park as a whole, because they used his idea all over Bletchley Park. In the early days, he was the only cryptographer who thought the problem was worth tackling. Others had given up. It's always difficult to say that if anyone is absolutely indispensable, but if anyone was indispensable, it was Turing. And last of all, Winston Churchill was a huge fan of these code breakers. He said the code breakers as a whole were the geese that laid the golden eggs, because these secrets they find by breaking these codes are invaluable, but never cackled. It's top secret stuff. They never spoke about it. After the war, they had a big bonfire at Bletchley Park and they destroyed all the work. All those bomb machines were pulled apart, destroyed by Winston Churchill's, Winston Churchill himself said, destroy this stuff because it's top secret stuff. If I tell you the truth, I think a couple of those machines were taken away in secret, but those were recycled in the end. They were pulled apart and used in something else. But by breaking this code, historians reckon these guys shortened the war by 2 years. There's Winston Churchill agreeing with me, okay? 2 years. And these guys saved lives. And they're not soldiers, but it is about, using your brains to save lives. Brains over bullets. And that's where I'll stop. Thank you. Sorry, I was packing in loads of details in that, and we'll get out as soon as acceptable.
Well, so we'd like to let the students have the first chance.
Okay, let's do that.
Yeah. Just small question. The machine showed us didn't have the special German letters.
No special German letters. So there were versions of Enigma that would have, but the military version, the Enigma I, this version did not. Have the German characters, did not have numbers, punctuation, or space. So it was stripped down, it was as basic as they could make it. I think that's to make it portable, because they want to make it as lightweight as possible. The reason it lights up, instead of printing, is to make it portable, because to carry with the carriage and the paper, that made it 8 times heavier. So it lights up because it's a lightweight, portable machine. Well, I say lightweight. It weighs 13 kilograms. Which is the equivalent to 13 1-kilogram weights. You're welcome. Give me another question, if you have one.
Why German never update the machine itself?
Say that again, sorry.
Why German never update the machine?
Did the Germans never update the machine itself? Is that right? So they were increasing the procedure, but not the machine itself. The U-boats did add an extra rotor. But that was simply an adaptation of what it was already. So they just fit in an extra rotor. They were experimenting with other versions of it, but that was too late in the war. They never used it. They had a little experiment, but it was never used. Yeah, so it was pretty much that was what they were using, yeah, including the Navy and including these U-boats with a little adaption. Is there any other? Hi.
So the development was the development taken over from a commercial company. Which entity was leading the developing and all those procedures updates during the war?
So who was leading those procedure updates? The company was supplying the machines. So it's a nice contract for them. Because it's a company like any other technological company or technology company today. Yeah, they were supplying the military. I think the procedures come from the military themselves. I think that's true. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so it was the military who was responsible
for those procedures. Yes, I think that's right. Yeah. Perhaps I can take another?
So how many, this attack depends on you having access to plain text.
Yeah.
How many would you expect to get per day?
Oh, how many messages to get per day? They were getting a vast number of them. I can tell you an exact figure for the Polish, because they did a measure at one point, and they were breaking 75% of Enigma messages.
Yeah, but I mean in number, like how many would they?
The magnitude of how many? Yeah. I can't say. It would be hundreds of messages there every day. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So you're getting lots of messages in, yes. So you can, that helps you out, exactly. You can try your known plain text attack or your tricks on a different message. If it doesn't work for that one, try it with a different one. Yeah, so that's helpful. That's helping you out. Is there any others? Oh, hi, sorry.
Yeah, I don't know if you want to expand the story of that to the picture of Turing.
He was thinking along those lines together, I guess. At Princeton, and this was after he did his Turing machine idea, but he was, as a hobby, working on his own code machine. So
he was in Princeton before the war.
He was Princeton, yeah, before the war, yeah. Yes, yeah, that's right. Yeah, he would have conversations with them. Yeah. Did I hear you right? Did I hear that?
Yeah. So is there a story in which he somehow stimulated also the development of the computer?
I can't say. No, I think the von Neumann story is that he attended a lecture by von Neumann at Cambridge, which was his inspiration to take on the decision problem. And that's when he started thinking of Turing machines. So that inspired him to think of computation.
And was there any interesting interaction with
Gödel's stuff? Yeah, because he was, his Turing machine was kind of in response to the Gödel problems and decision problems, yeah. That's all together. Did that make sense? Is there any other questions for me? Thank you.